Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 40, Novels as Spycraft, 7, Dashiell Hammett, Pinkerton Hop, The Copper Wars, and The Murder of Frank Little. Today I'm recording from Butte, Montana. It's a funny thing, right? When people think of leftists or reds, there's all kinds of stereotypes that come up, right? Like the Mr. Show skit, or someone who unironically says America caca, like a soy-facing guy, you know, maybe the most annoying person you know, depending. I don't agree, obviously, but this is what some people say and think, right? They're thinking of people who don't lift, in other words, or who don't have fun. Sometimes they conflate it with Democrats in general, but, you know, this is what you hear. And sure, maybe everyone's kind of pathetic when filtered through the internet, but this is not historically accurate when we look through U.S. history. Certainly before the New Left in the 60s and 70s, right? In fact, in a lot of cases, Reds were tough men and women, tough workers, sometimes even a bit sleazy, but in a proletarian way. I have some issues with formulating it as dirtbag, but it's not terribly far off from that either. I'm talking about Dashiell Hammett, the author whose detective novels both smashed, reestablished, and transcended the genre conventions of detective fiction. Side note here, when I was younger, I liked Raymond Chandler better than Dashiell Hammett because his prose was flashier. As I've gotten older, I've completely reversed my position. Hammett was a serious man who saw some shit, and I can't forgive Raymond Chandler for certain crimes, like, say, not, like, forgetting who killed the chauffeur when he wrote The Big Sleep. I love Hammett's work. Right. Hammett was an American Red who started his life as a spy. We'll get into that. He was also an incredibly jaded, cynical, and damaged man. His daughter said of him, as a boy, he wanted to find the ultimate truth, how the world operated. There was no system except blind chance. Unquote. Having achieved great success through what must have felt to him like random chance, he both wasted his money and donated large amounts of both his money and his time to social justice causes. With his feet against the fire, Hammett refused to name names. Hammett was a mensch. Let's get into it. So Samuel Dashiell Hammett was born in Maryland in 1894. He came from a French Huguenot family on his mother's side, and the Hammett side were tobacco farmers. In a 1924 interview with the crime magazine Black Mask, Hammett said, "The only remarkable thing about his family was that there were, on his mother's side, 16 French soldiers who never saw a battle." On this same French side, in going back to that martial tradition, they had a family motto, which is probably the funniest family motto I've ever heard. Ni tôt, ni tard. Neither soon nor late. No one ever accused them of being overachievers. Hammett grew up Catholic in and around Philadelphia and Baltimore. He wrote about his mother giving him two pieces of good advice as a youth. Never go out in a boat without oars, son, even if it's the Queen Mary, and don't waste your time on women who can't cook, because they're not likely to be much fun in the other rooms either. Which, like, if we extend that advice to both genders, I think it's probably good advice. In this period, everyone knew him as Sam, not Dashiell. Hammett did the classic thing of switching names depending on the context, so he knew what era or what context people knew him from, which is a nice trick. If you have the means, if you've been blessed with a middle name, try it sometime, it can be fun. The Hammett family was not rich, or maybe it would be better to say the family fortunes had declined. Hammett had to leave school at 14 to help support the family. Like, he had to work. As a youth, Hammett had to work, and he hated working. Or at least, he hated the jobs that he was working. There's a story of Hammett working as a messenger boy, but arriving late to work every day for a straight week. The boss asked him to quit if he was going to be late all the time. So Hammett quit on the spot. His boss said, like, wait. If you give me your word that it won't happen again, you can keep the job. Hammett said, no, I can't promise that. And so the boss was so puzzled by his moxie that he let Hammett stay on at the job. Hammett would end up quitting shortly thereafter anyway. Hammett worked for stockbrokers. I'm not going necessarily in order here, but like, he worked for stockbrokers, machine manufacturers, and canners. He worked at a brokerage. He worked as a dock worker. As a dock worker, or stevedore, he said, I made the grade, but then it became too strenuous. He also worked on the railroads. He worked as a paperboy, obviously more when he was younger. He worked briefly as an advertising clerk and a salesman. In a later interview with Black Mask magazine, Hammett described himself as, quote, very lazy, and, quote, I have no ambition at all in the usual sense of the word, unquote. Which, like, damn, he just liked me for real. I've learned something about myself over time. I really love lazy authors, apparently. Although he was a slacker dirtbag and ne'er-do-well, Hammett read widely, including science manuals, yes, also mystery stories. He also read pretty much anything he could get his hands on, like Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Finally, around 20, Hammett saw an advertisement in a Baltimore newspaper. Wanted, a bright, experienced salesman to handle good line, salary, and commission. Excellent opportunity for right man to connect with first line house. Based on the ad, he had no reason to believe that the ad had been placed by the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, so he answered it. The reason why it sounded like an ad for a sales job is because the Pinkerton agency found that they could both maintain their secrecy that way, and because they also simply found that many of the skills that make someone a good salesperson also make good general operatives, which was their term for detectives. They would also use similarly obscure and murky ads to recruit strike breakers. Hammett would work as both. Hammett was called to interview at the Continental Trust Company building on Baltimore Street, which was an imposing building at the time, which was covered by small stone falcons. He was hired to work for the Pinkertons, whose slogan was, "We never sleep." The job meant being on call 24/7, working long hours just for $21 a week. One day I would like to go through the history of the Pinkertons. I know some of it, and I've read some of one book on the Pinkertons. It's incredibly interesting, and there's so much to it. Good and mostly bad. I'll refrain from going through that history. We'll return to Hammett in a minute, but suffice to say that I think the best part of Red Dead Redemption 2 is that there are Pinkertons that you can interact with. It has been observed that Hammett was something of a reclusive, distant weirdo, at least, you know, when he was younger, and he found a profession that encouraged and valued those traits. Hammett wrote later that, quote, being a professional busybody requires more energy, more dogged patience than you'd suppose. He also said, quote, there was never anything lacking in the matter of my curiosity. He also said, I liked gumshoeing better than anything I had done before. Now, although this is maybe not espionage in the sense that most people think, Hammett working for the Pinkertons was essentially spy work, albeit domestic spying, right? In that sense, of course, this is absolutely a novels as spycraft entry. And oh, how Hammett got interesting assignments. I'll say by way of disclaimer that Hammett is not entirely to be trusted. There are many, many times that he He told stories that you could charitably call embellished. And certainly he told stories that appear to be not true. We will dissect this in a little bit. Then again, it's important to note that what the Pinkertons got up to and what they said to the public were not always truthful either. So there are perhaps some stories that were not just him talking shit, if that makes sense. Still, if even half of the stories are true, and many of them can be, like, verified, he really had a wild career in the Pinkertons. Also, to be fair, he was not exactly like a lifelong Pinkerton operative. Like, he only worked, you know, a handful of years with them because for various circumstances he had to, like, stop, go back, and then he had to, like, retire. So we'll get to that. Hammett liked to tell about a case he investigated where he literally had to catch a man who had stolen a Ferris wheel. In another case, he said he spent 3 months in a hospital pretending to be an invalid in order to spy on a patient who shared the same hospital room. One of Hammett's daughters wrote, "One of my earliest memories is of getting to feel the dent in my father's head from being hit by a brick when he bungled a tailing job, and he let me see the knife tip embedded in the palm of his hand." His other daughter said, "You could feel it in later years. There was a dent in the back of his head like the corner of a brick." The Pinkertons sent Hammett all over the United States. He worked in Baltimore, Spokane, Seattle, and San Francisco. They also taught him how to write, as in, the ops, the agents, had to write extensive reports on their activities for their supervisors. These supervisors were no nonsense and would abide no embellishments. Hammett would state years later that the Pinkerton agency taught him how to write, kind of like Hemingway working for a newspaper, something like that, right? You know why they call detectives private eyes? Other than the obvious allusion to spying with your eyes on behalf of private interests. Like, the term is so seemingly, like, descriptive that you don't think to wonder, you know, where it came from. But it also specifically refers to the Pinkerton logo, which I might make the art for the episode, but if you haven't seen it, I highly encourage you to Google Pinkerton logo, especially the original one. It uses an incredibly Masonic all-seeing eye. And what makes a good detective? One former Pinkerton said, "A good general operative was a man who, quote, can be relied on to do the right thing, even in the absence of instructions from the executive department, and who will at all times act in a cool, discreet, and level-headed manner," unquote. Hammett would explain to friends and family that shadowing people was the main trick of the job, and he wrote, "Keep behind your subject as much as possible. Never try to hide from him. Act in a natural manner no matter what happens, and never meet his eye." Alan Pinkerton, the founder of the Pinkertons, wrote, "A detective may shadow a man for days, and in the end have but the haziest idea of the man's features, tricks of carriage, ways of wearing clothes, the general outline, individual mannerisms, all as seen from the rear, are much more important to the shadow than faces. They can be recognized at a greater distance and do not necessitate his getting in front of his subject at any time," unquote. Conversely, sometimes Pinkertons just went undercover, like fake identities, for long periods of time. Like Hammett in the hospital room, right? Or infiltrating the Molly Maguires, the secret society / quasi-union / quasi-terrorist organization, as one of their most famous operatives, James McParland, had done. Alan Pinkerton also said, "The profession of the detective is at once an honorable and highly useful one. For practical benefits, few professions excel it. He is an officer of justice, and must himself be pure and above reproach. The great essential is to prevent his identity from becoming known, even among his associates of respectable character, and when he fails to do this, when the nature of his calling is discovered and made known, his usefulness to the profession is at an end, and failure certain and inevitable is the result. Unquote. It's funny. Biographers of Dashiell Hammett point out that Hammett would tell people that he learned the tricks of the trade from a Pinkerton operative named Jimmy Wright. People will sometimes say that Hammett's detective, the Continental Op, was based on this Jimmy Wright character. However, there was no Jimmy Wright. If you check the Pinkerton archive in the Library of Congress, you can find the names of all known Pinkerton operatives, and Jimmy Wright is not listed. That's because Jimmy Wright was a popular alias among Pinkertons working undercover, which is an interesting phenomenon you see with various spooks, certain names being used frequently and or pertaining to people who don't exist, and or, you know, multiple spies using that name, which tends to confuse people who might be trying to track down, you know, what was going on. I think that this may have been one of the tricks that intelligence got from the underworld, because there are various examples outside of intelligence that use this. Like, for example, it's pretty common for carnies to, in the old days, all use the name Peter Collins, or yeggs using the name John Ryan. Interesting, right? I think that there's a bunch of different names that different intelligence would use. I have a couple of them written down, but it's a very, very interesting thing to think about. Now, the Pinkerton Archive in the Library of Congress has 60,000 documents, including memos, salary lists, cipher books, operative reports, final reports to clients, brochures, and books of mugshots. No reports by Dashiell Hammett have ever been identified, which does not mean that he wasn't a Pinkerton. It means that it means a couple things. It means either that his reports were not filed under his name, which was not an uncommon practice, or that his reports were lost. But again, this is not surprising because of that practice, but also because in the 1930s, the Pinkerton Agency did major purges of their records after Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, and they realized that many of their records indicated illegal activity. Hammett, for his part, wrote, "Thanks to my ability to write pleasing and convincing reports, my reputation was always a little more than I deserved." Unquote. This is characteristic Hammett. He insists that he was a decent but not brilliant detective, and that he had a better reputation than he deserved because he could write good reports. In an interview with Hammett's daughter Mary in 1975, she said she was shocked when her father told her that he had been offered $5,000 to kill an organizer for the International Workers of the World named Frank Little. Mary was familiar with her father's political views, and this went in the face of everything he believed in. Mary said, "It was a shock when I heard about it, and I said, 'You mean you were working for the Pinkertons against the IWW? And he said, "That's right." She also said, "He didn't care if his clients were bums, he was strictly out to do his job." Unquote. Now, it's interesting because a lot of biographers do not believe that this happened, that Hammett was offered $5,000 to kill Frank Little. Let's discuss what happened in Butte, Montana in 1917 to see if we can get closer to the truth. So in July 1917, a man named Frank Little arrived in Butte, Montana. Little was on crutches when he showed up because he had broken his leg in a strike in Minnesota. Little was a wobbly, a member of the International Workers of the World, the radical union formed out of the most hardcore elements of the Western Federation of Miners as well as a heady mixture of socialists, anarchists, and Marxists, who all opposed the business union policies of the American Federation of Labor. Little described himself as a proud half-breed of white and Indian heritage. He called himself half-white, half-Indian, all-wobbly. He was well-known as an effective organizer. As of 1917, he was 38 years old, already a veteran of several literal mining wars, as well as strikes, time in jail, attempted lynchings, and so on. Little was on strike in Bisbee, Arizona, when the Phelps Dodge Mining Company illegally rounded up and kidnapped the striking miners, and deported them by cattle car, dumping them in the New Mexico desert. People said Little was fearless. As the IWW decided to go against conscription, like during World War I, which was basically, literally an organizational death sentence, Little said, "They'll run us out of business anyhow. Better to go out in a blaze of glory than to give in. Either we're for this capitalist slaughter fest or we're against it. I'd rather take a firing squad." Unquote. And like, he's not being hyperbolic. There was a strong chance that like, opposing the war publicly, coming out against conscription could literally, could literally get you killed. As we'll see, many of them got heavy jail sentences. Now, Little's status as a wobbly can be measured by the fact that he was given a small pouch containing some of Joe Hill's ashes. Joe Hill, the martyr for the workers' rights movement, had been executed in 1915 in Utah, shamefully, and his ashes were distributed among some 600 organizers and organizations, including Frank Little. Now, when Little arrived in Butte, Montana, it was a powder keg of labor unrest. Federal troops had already been called to Butte in 1914. In June of 1917, a month before he showed up, there were draft riots relating to conscription, right? It's easy to forget how incredibly angry workers were at World War I, considering how they understood it as just one more particularly egregious instance of class war. And I am talking about literal class war. A massive mining disaster occurred in Butte on June 8th at the Speculator Mine, which had left 164 miners dead, half of them burned beyond all recognition. Why did this disaster happen? Because Anaconda Copper did not follow safety regulations specified by law. This led the surviving 15,000 miners to go out on strike. On top of the fact that many of them were being drafted against their will to go off to die in France for literally no reason, right? Literal class war. So a strike was on between the miners and the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, which is sometimes just charmingly called the Copper Trust, because that's what it was. Now, would you like to hear the striking workers' demands? The strikers had formed an as-yet unrecognized, unaffiliated, and illegal metal mine workers' union. Their seven demands were as follows. First, recognition of the union as the miners' bargaining agent. Second, abolition of the rustling card, which is roughly equivalent, I don't want to explain it, but it's roughly equivalent to open versus closed shops. Third, no blacklisting. Fourth, discharge of Montana's failed mining inspector. Fifth, strict enforcement of the state's mining laws. Sixth, higher wages. Seventh, the right to free speech and assemblage. It always strikes me how incredibly reasonable the strikers' demands are, right? Before Little arrived, the bosses had already dynamited one of their union halls. Like, I'm not being hyperbolic, this is literal class warfare, right? So Little was sent by the Wobblies to help educate, agitate, and organize the strikers. Against the strikers, there were Brown and Pinkerton detectives, Brown being another agency. There were hired thugs, there were strike breakers, there was the police, on the side of the mines as always. There were goons and gun thugs, and if things got out of control, there was always the federal troops ready to be brought in. Against all of this, the miners were trying to win a union. As I said, the union was still unrecognized, unaffiliated, and illegal. When Frank Liddell arrived in Butte, Montana, he checked into a boarding house near Finlander Hall. The next day, he spoke to the workers. The Butte Miner newspaper described Liddell as, quote, a frail man supporting the weight of his body with the aid of crutches, his face contorted with physical pain and the passion which rocked his body. The speaker worked himself into a maniacal fury as he denounced the capitalists of every class and nationality, unquote. In this speech, Liddell called World War I a capitalist slaughter fest and called the doughboys Uncle Sam scabs in uniform. He called Butte's company-owned newspapers prostitutes of the press and called for worldwide revolution. You gotta hand it to Frank Liddell. An anonymous spy, who could theoretically actually be Dashiell Hammett for all we know, described a July 25th closed IWW meeting at Finlander Hall, which quoted Frank Liddell as saying, quote, "We have no set rules to go by, but we organize, call a strike, and use any means necessary to win that strike. And that is the reason the bosses don't like us. He can't handle us, and he knows that we will handle him in the near future. Use any means necessary. It don't make any difference what those means are, but use them to win your strike." Unquote.
Joe Hill's best song. Sorry, we almost missed the damn thing. Chorus is, there is power in a band of working folks, when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. I'll teach you the chorus. There is power in a band of working folks, when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. Have you got that again? You understand the chorus? Everybody got it now? All right. Oh, would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? Oh, would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folks when we stand. One industrial union grand. Oh, would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack that's away in the back? Oh, would you have wings up in heaven to fly and start here with a rack on your back? But there is power in a band of working folk when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. Oh, if you like sluggers to feed in your head, don't organize, all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folks when we stand. That's the power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. So come all ye workers from every land, and come join the grand industrial band. But then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folks when we stand. real Union brand.
Power to the Union.
According to the same informants, the next day, Lidl scolded the strike leaders, saying, "You fellows are conducting a peaceful strike. Great God, what would Uncle Sam say to the soldiers he is sending to meet the German army if they laid down their arms and said, 'We are conducting a peaceful war'?" The day after that, July 27th, Frank Lidl gave his second public speech in Butte, where Lidl said the U.S. Constitution is a mere scrap of paper which can be torn up, which, my words here, we would quickly see the truth of that statement in just a little bit. Lidl also called President Woodrow Wilson a lying tyrant. Again, also true. By August 1st, 1917, Frank Lidl would be dead. A black Cadillac carrying masked men showed up at his boarding house and abducted him. They tied him to the back of the Cadillac and dragged him a block, which scraped off his kneecaps. They then arrived at the Milwaukee Railway Trestle on the outskirts of town and hung Frank Lidl. On his body, the masked men left a note written in red ink, which read, "Others take notice. First and last warning. 3777. And below that, there were seven initials. The letters LDCSSWT. And the L was circled. Now, the cowards, the prostitutes of the press, as Lidl said, the cowards at the mining company newspapers speculated that the numbers on this note referred to Frank Lidl's draft number, and they speculated that maybe he committed suicide to avoid the draft. That, of course, is insane gaslighting bullshit, of course, because 3777 was a well-known symbol of frontier justice. Meaning, like, it refers to the standard dimensions for a coffin and or grave. Like, you can see the numbers on certain Montana state trooper patches to this day. The letters on the notes clearly refer to the leaders of the strike: William Dunn, Tom Campbell, Joe Shannon, Dan Shovlin, John Williams, and Leon Tomich. With Frank Lidl being the first circled, you know, referring to him being, you know, the first victim. This was a clear, direct threat that everybody understood except the journalists at the company newspaper. Although that's false, they understood it too. They were just, you know, it's their job to lie, so. On August 5th, 3,000 miners walked the 4 miles from the funeral home to the cemetery carrying Frank Lidl's casket. They carried a red banner which read, "A Martyr to Solidarity," and they sang La Marseillaise. On August 10th, federal troops were called in, just like in 1914. Because of this, the strike ultimately collapsed, and federal troops remained in Butte, Montana throughout the war, guarding the production of copper, which was vital to the national interests. None of the killers of Frank Lidl were ever found or prosecuted. Interestingly, the Butte District Attorney wired to the Attorney General saying that he received a report that Frank Lidl's killers were wearing U.S. Army uniforms. One newspaper even published the names of the men who took part in the killing: William Oates, Herman Gillies, Pete Bedeen, a rat named Middleton, and a chief gunman named Ryan. This newspaper wrote that every man, woman, and child in the county knows that company agents perpetuated this foulest of all crimes. It is interesting, however, to think about the strong possibility that U.S. Army soldiers could have carried the murder out. The publication Solidarity published a poem to Frank Lidl written by Viola Gilbert Snell, which I will read. "Traitor and demagogue, wanton breeder of discontent, that is what they called you. Those cowards who condemn sabotage, but hide themselves, not only behind masks and cloaks, but behind all the armored positions of property and prejudice and the law. staunch friend and comrade, soldier of solidarity, like some bitter magic, the tale of your tragic death has spread throughout the land, and from 1,000 miles has torn the last shreds of doubt concerning might and right. Young, virile, and strong, like grim sentinels they stand, awaiting every opportunity to break another of slavery's chains. For whatever stroke is needed, they are preparing. So shall you be avenged. In September, the feds arrested 165 Wobblies. I don't mean just in Butte, Montana. This is nationwide, including the entirety of the Union's top leadership, for criminal conspiracy. Ultimately, 101 of them would receive prison sentences of upwards of 20 years. I think the charge for most of them was literally sedition. This was one of the main reasons why Big Bill Haywood, one of the IWW leaders, skipped bail and sought asylum in the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. While we're on the topic, we might as well state what Big Bill Haywood thought of private detectives while we're at it. When a detective dies, he goes so low he has to climb a ladder to get into hell, and he is not a welcome guest there. When his satanic majesty sees him coming, he says to his imps, "Go get a big bucket of pitch and a lot of sulfur, and give them to that fellow and put him outside. Let him start a hell of his own. We don't want him in here starting trouble." Unquote. The problems did not end there for Butte, Montana. In 1920, 16 striking miners were shot from behind outside a mine in Butte. This would become known as the Anaconda Road Massacre. It killed one striker, no prosecutions. There's stronger evidence to suggest that Hammett might have been around to witness the Anaconda Road Massacre. It's more tenuous whether he was actually in Butte, you know, when Frank Little was murdered. And you know I cannot refrain from mentioning who owned Anaconda Copper. The company started as the Anaconda Mining Company, owned by Marcus Daly, who was one of the three copper kings of Montana, who had ties to the Hearst family. Daly ended up acquiring the Anaconda Mine, which was, at that point, the largest known deposit of copper in the entire world. Daly ultimately sold his company to William Rockefeller and H.H. Rogers of Standard Oil for $39 million. This, of course, back in 1899. That became Amalgamated Copper Mining Company. The French Rothschilds bought in and attempted to corner the market on copper. They owned roughly a quarter of Anaconda's stock at one point. They would go on to own upwards of 40% of the world supply of copper. Anaconda eventually expanded operations into Mexico and Chile, which, you know. Interestingly, Che Guevara would visit the Chuquicamata mine in Chile on his famous motorcycle trip all over South America, which contributed to his radicalization. By the way, the bosses and fat cats who owned the copper companies are all, of course, going to hell, but unfortunately, we are stuck here today with their shitty poser children who are still around, right? Those who have ears to hear, let them hear. So, to return to Dashiell Hammett, we have to address his claim that an officer of Anaconda Copper had offered him $5,000 to kill Frank Little. Hammett would tell various people this story, but the best recorded version comes from his long-term partner, Lillian Hellman, who wrote that he said, quote, "I had no political conscience in 1917. I was just doing a job, and if our clients were rotten, it didn't concern me. They hired us to break up a union strike, so we went out to Butte to do that," unquote. Hellman said that Hammett turned the offer down, the offer to kill Frank Little, that is. She also believed that the incident explained a lot about Hammett. She wrote, Through the years, he was able to repeat that bribe offer so many times that I came to believe, knowing him now, that it was a kind of key to his life. He had given a man the right to think he would murder. I think I can date Hammett's belief that he was living in a corrupt society from Liddell's murder. Unquote. Hellman believes that Hammett had a hard time accepting that he was involved in what had happened there at Butte. On the flip side, various English professors and academic types find the story implausible. To be fair, it does seem unlikely that a recent, somewhat inexperienced new recruit from Baltimore would be the go-to hitman. On the flip side, it's not like this was a terribly complicated assassination either. Though, again, to be fair, $5,000 does seem pretty steep. The irony, however, is that there's no proof that the story is not true either. The people who doubt that the story happened do not have evidence. It's pretty much just Hammett's word against the fact that he was kind of a drunk who would just talk shit. We can pretty much prove certain other stories Hammett told about his time at the Pinkertons were false, or embellished. But, to be fair, Hammett's story about being offered money to murder did not change over time, it did not get more dramatic over time, and he would not only tell it when he was drunk at Hollywood parties. He would also tell it consistently to his closest friends and family. And he would tell it as a shameful story, like he told his romantic partner and his children. Not exactly the same as like talking shit while you're drunk at a bar, right? Now, there are a few pieces of evidence to support the idea that this story happened, at least in some sense. First, Butte was not Hammett's first rodeo. He had already worked as a gun thug and a strike breaker for the Pinkertons in other strikes. Second, Hammett's daughter, Jo Hammett, found a family photo, which she includes in her memoir, which shows her father working as a strike breaker. In this photo, you can see him standing with a bunch of thugs holding a heavy switch, and some of them were holding saps. Like, we know for sure he was a strike breaker. Finally, and all credit to Nathan Ward, the author, for finding this, I'll quote him here on one of the best arguments that the story is true. And I quote, "The best evidence is one advanced in a 1982 paper by the Moscow, Idaho bookstore owner Robert Green. A detective named Hammett takes part in the death of a suspect in Upton Sinclair's 1920 protest novel, 100% the story of a patriot. But even if the two men had met in the teens, and Sinclair heard it from Hammett's own lips, that would not prove that Hammett had taken part in the crime or that he was even in Butte that summer. Still, Green's view of Hammett as a writer seeking absolution for his crimes is an interesting one that also mirrors and reflects crime writer James Ellroy." Unquote. Maybe to make that more clear, Upton Sinclair wrote a protest novel which included a character named Hammett doing very similar activities, right? Again, I don't think this means that Hammett literally killed Frank Liddell. According to Hammett, he didn't. He said he was offered it. But it's interesting, right? Like, if anyone was keyed into some of these strikes and labor movements, it was Upton Sinclair. And they very well, I think they did know each other. So the possibility that this is true is bolstered somewhat. Now, maybe I've told this unclearly, or maybe I'm not being very clear, but an additional reason why I'm spending so much time dissecting this isn't just because it tells us a lot about Dashiell Hammett, though it does. It's also because Hammett wrote a novel, Red Harvest, in 1929, which is basically all about these events in Butte, Montana. Not specifically about Frank Liddell, but just the mining wars. Now, in the novel Red Harvest, which I highly, highly recommend, Hammett's character, his recurring character, the Continental Op, arrives in a town called Personville, which is frequently called Poisonville by the locals. Poisonville is a mining town in the West in the 1920s. It is a direct stand-in for Butte. In the novel, there's a character named Elihu Wilson, who is a direct stand-in for Marcus Daly, the old mining czar. This character, in the novel, brought in an army of criminals to crush the miners' union. But that basically meant that after the strike, you know, after the union was crushed, that Poisonville was run by different factions of criminals, which the character was upset about because he wanted to run the town, being the mining czar, right? Even the ways Hammett describes the town matches Butte in the old days. Like, I'm not blowing any minds here. This is well-known stuff, and this interpretation is one that, like, just about everybody agrees with. It's interesting nevertheless. Anyway, the Continental Op works for one faction of criminals, then he works for another. He provokes an all-out gang war, which ultimately destroys both factions. One of the characters is even a stand-in for one of the suspected murderers of Frank Little. This real-life thug would eventually be found beaten to death in 1922. The Continental Op, in carrying out this gang war, basically, he gets a taste for violence, and he worries about going blood simple. Now, the reason why the novel is so good is because Hammett saw this shit, like, with his own eyes. Whether or not he was offered $5,000 to kill Frank Little, there is a lot of evidence that he was in Butte and saw this world himself. Additionally, it's not just that Dashiell Hammett was there, but Hammett's wife, Josephine Dolan, actually grew up in Butte, Montana. And get this, she was the daughter of a West Virginia miner. And then, I think her dad died, I'm pretty sure, and her mom, I think, married an executive at Anaconda Copper Mining Company. If that won't produce some schizophrenic, you know, feelings about the time and place you were born, I don't know what would. Like, it occurs to me personally, this is my personal read, and maybe people would disagree, but Red Harvest to me reads a little bit like wish fulfillment. Like, the Continental Op does what Hammett wishes maybe he could have done, which is to say, set the different factions of criminals against each other, just bring the whole thing down. Like, if the offer to murder Frank Little for money was the key to his life, so too was Red Harvest. Then, using that same logic, I think Red Harvest was a fever dream of Hammett wishing revenge on a corrupt society, taking revenge on the world. Now, the French author and Nobel Prize winner André Gide wrote about Red Harvest, and he said, "I regard Red Harvest as a remarkable achievement, the last word in atrocity, cynicism, and horror. Dashiell Hammett's dialogues, in which every character is trying to deceive all the others, and in which the truth slowly becomes visible through a fog of deception, can be compared only with the best in Hemingway." Unquote. I'll do him one better. Here's a controversial take. I think Hammett is better than Hemingway. Still, like, I completely agree, Red Harvest is some of the most cynical stuff I've ever read, actually. It's freaking wild. I highly recommend it. Next episode, we'll get into the latter half of Hammett's life.
froze over Homestake in the early morning fog. And a man got off a train bound straight for glory, with a red card in his pocket and a fire in his eye. Frank Little was his name, and this his story. To the town of Butte, Montana, where they worked down in the mines, trading waking hours for blood and sweat and sorrow, digging copper for the bosses while they throw us nopper dimes, and praying that we'll see the sun tomorrow. Just 2 weeks ago, 1,000 feet beneath the ground, 200 men burned alongside their brothers against the doorless bulkheads of a speculator mine. They probably died calling for their mothers. Frank Little walked into the town and made his reason known. He's a wobbly that has been sent from Chicago. He's organized the workers from the mountains to the sea, and he's here to fight for you and fight for me. The lumber camps out in Missoula, to the quarries of Spokane, to the oil fields and the dock boys of Wisconsin, even the migrant workers on the California farms, he organized and inspired his fellow man. We're gonna strike, we're gonna strike, we're gonna strike, boys, like you never struck before. From the mines up to the shops, we're gonna pull out all the stops, and we'll never stand alone forevermore. You're a worker of the world. Stood with us through the beatings from the company's hired men, till the picket line stretched on 100,000. Side by side we made a promise we would not be slaves again, deafening the bosses with our howling. The workers Little told are worth 1,000 years in gold. We were never meant to bleed for bread and roses. Can't give up this fight. Hold the picket line tonight. Workers of the world, unite, unite. Morning, they kicked in Frankie's door and drug him naked out into the street. Those yellow bastards tortured him, company men and Pinkertons. They tied him up and knocked him off his feet. The sun rose over Homestake in the early morning fog, and a mountain wind went whistling through the trees. Frank Little swung there gently from the Milwaukee Bridge, a noose round his neck and blood running down his knee. Well, they thought they'd break the strike if they took Frank Little's life, but the company was gravely mistaken. From Haymarket to Montana is a sea of red bandanas, and the breath of revolution can't be taken.